This is a test. This is the Union County History Project interview with David Mackey in Cove, Oregon. It is December 17, 2005. Okay, thank you for meeting with me today. Dave, would you tell me your full name and your birth date and where you were born?
My name is David Emo Mackey. I'm 51% Finlander. Mm-hmm. I was born in Deadwood, South Dakota, and raised in Lead, about 3 miles up the hill from Deadwood, in a gold mining town where the Homestead Gold Mine is.
Tell me your middle name again and how to spell that.
Eino, E-I-N-O. And that's my dad's first name, of course.
Now, we know you're not from Union County, so when did you first end up in Union County, and how did that happen? What brought you here?
Well, I was finishing up my Bachelor of Industrial Technology degree in Cheney, Washington, and was in the hallway waiting to see my professor advisor, and his telephone rang, and I heard him say, "Yeah, we've got a man out here in the hallway." And so he motioned me to come in and said, "Say, the superintendent from the Grand Oregon's on the phone. He's looking for an industrial arts teacher." And so I went to the phone, and he said, he just told me about the position in the Grand, and the first question I asked him was, "Do you have skiing in the area?" He says, "Yeah, we have a brand new area to the south and an older area to the north, Spot Springs." And I said, "Okay, I'll be down." And so this buddy of mine was ready to graduate and in need of a job. They needed two industrial arts teachers, so we both drove down here on Memorial Day. And
Memorial Day of what year?
1967. Mm-hmm. And so we came down, and the superintendent and the principal met us, showed us the facilities, and no formal interview. We just they asked us if we could, make a good program out of this place. And we both agreed that we could and make some nice changes and have a heck of a good program. So they said, "Well, we'd like to send you a contract." And we said, "Okay." And then went back to school.
Up in Cheney.
In Cheney, Washington.
And then, so you received the contract in the mail?
So we got our contract in the mail, and both of us hired out that fall of 1967.
Did you both stay this whole time? Did your friend stay the same amount of time you did here?
Oh, he taught about the first, he taught 3 years at the middle school, and then he taught at the high school for about another 3 or 4 years. And then he got a different job and moved on with a different career.
Who was your buddy's name? What was your buddy's name that came to look around at you at that time?
Joe Lissick. And I think he's in Pendleton now. He sells real estate.
Really?
But he was a smoke jumper in the Grand at the time. So he knew about the Grand, and he said, "Boy, it'd be a great place to live." And he knew the airport, of course, and they had a smoke jumper's place to sleep, a little like a cabin almost. And so we drove out there and got, free board.
That's where you stayed when you came to interview the superintendent.
Yeah,
we stayed over. Grand Public School.
We stayed overnight.
Okay, so you received a contract in the mail, and you signed it, mm-hmm. and so you began teaching in the fall of 67
right.
in the Grand.
Right.
Where did you first live?
I lived at Shirley Apartments, downtown the Grand, about a block from the old Sacagawea Annex. It's still there, of course. But the Sacagawea Hotel was up at that time.
Were you already married? Did you have a family when you came to LeGrand?
No, I came to LeGrand single.
And then you married here.
I married in LeGrand. I met my wife at a church potluck in Riverside Park. That fall.
Okay. What church did you belong to?
Seventh-day Adventist.
And you met your wife at
a church potluck. It was kind of like prearranged. They had a table all set up. And in fact, this thing got started because I had met the airport manager who happened to be an Adventist when I came down, you know, to stay overnight for an interview. And of course, he found out right away I wasn't married. And so his wife was a real go-getter for getting people together. So she's the one that kind of instigated it and got us together at this potluck. They kind of like steered us through the table. So I was on one side and Ginger was on the other side, and that's where they introduced us at the picnic table. So that's how we met.
What's your wife's name, and when and where did you get married?
My wife's name is Ginger, and we got married in LeGrand in June of 1968.
Is your wife from LeGrand?
No, she was from Miles City, Montana. And if I remember correctly, was it your mother or grandmother?
Grandmother.
My wife's grandmother was the first white lady born in that area of Miles City.
Eastern half of Montana. In about 1860 something. It was just a year or two after the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
So anyway, we both come from, you know, similar backgrounds in terms of the kind of town we lived in, a small town, not too far from each other, just a couple hundred miles, but we met in LeGrand.
In LeGrand. So, when did you get married?
June 1968.
And
Ginger was working in Portland as a nurse, and she had just finished up nursing school, and the day I met her, after that potluck, they had an evening social and got us more acquainted that evening. And so I walked her out to her car and asked if she would be interested in dating a poor school teacher Thanksgiving. And my sister was living in Portland, so we drove over to Portland and had Thanksgiving at my sister's house, and then Ginger invited me over to her place the next day. At it was Portland Sanitarium where she was working. There are nurses' apartments, and she had a roommate. So
is that over in the Belmont area there, 60th and Belmont?
Uh huh. That's where the old building was.
Okay, so where did you get married?
At the First Lutheran Church in LeGrand.
In LeGrand.
Right on 4th Street.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're married in 68, you've got a new career now as an industrial arts teacher.
That's right.
Let's talk about that first. Which school did you take on? Were you always in the same grade level or the same school? What exactly did you teach?
I taught my first 3 years at the LeGrand Middle School in the old building. Now that old building is still there, and it's now a maintenance department. But it was in the ground floor of this maintenance department where I had my metal working program. And I had a drafting program in the back end of that building, which was in the basement underneath the band room. And so the big bass drum, you know, would really rattle the ceiling during class many times. And then my buddy hired out to be a woodworking teacher and started a plastics program.
So you did the metal shop and the drafting.
And the drafting. And an occasional math class.
An industrial math or a general math?
It was a general math.
Yeah.
And then, after the first 3 years, I was offered a fellowship position at Eastern Washington State College, which is what it was called at that time. And so I accepted that and went up there to work on my master's degree. And all I had to do was teach one engineering drafting class. And the other fellow that was there was on a similar type fellowship, and we had to work out some different activities for like tours of the campus, tours of the department for industrial people to come in and, you know, see the program. And we had a lot of fun that year. Ginger nursed up there, and that's when GI Bill was starting up again. So
are you a veteran?
I'm a veteran, U.S. Army veteran.
Okay.
So it worked out really well because of the GI Bill. That was a good incentive to get back and finish up my master's one year instead of stretching it out into five summers.
Right.
I just couldn't stand the thought of
it. You wanted to get it done and over with.
Done and over with.
Now, did you do your military service before you entered college?
Yes.
So, although that takes us out of Union County, I would like to know, you said that you're a U.S. Army vet.
Yes.
Served from when to when?
From 1960 to 1963. And between the first 6 months was in Fort Raleigh, Kansas. I was a machinist. That's where I had my basic and my first tour of duty. And then I went to France and was stationed in Saint Jean d'Angely, France, which is in the southwest part of France, north of just a short distance north of Bordeaux, and which was pretty neat because my dad had fought there during World War II in the same country.
Now, what was your MOS? Do you recall?
433, machinist.
Machinist was 433.
Yeah.
Okay. What rank did you attain?
Spec 4.
And that's what you were discharged as, a specialist for? Okay.
It was easy for me to make that rank in the first, I think I got it in 14 to 16 months. So it was really easy for me to climb up there because I had an excellent vocational program in high school. And it just helped me excel for doing things in the Army. So.
Okay, so getting back to LeGrand, then you got a fellowship at Eastern Washington to complete a master's, and the master's degree was eventually in?
It was in industrial technology again.
And awarded by Eastern Washington.
Yes, yes.
And now, what about your job while you were gone? Did you give up your job in LeGrand, or were you like on a extended sabbatical? What?
It was a leave of absence, and I could have my job back only if it was available. So when my year was up, I went down to LeGrand to visit my wife's brother, sister-in-law, and both of us visited. The job wasn't available. The fellow that took my place was going to stay. So Buzz Fulton and Dale White was the principal. Buzz Fulton was vice principal. We bumped onto them on the street in front of a church where they were having a dance, some kind of a school dance, and they were there to supervise. And so we just had a nice chat on the street, and Dale White asked me, he said, "Would you consider coming back to the high school if we made a spot for you?" I said, "Yeah, I'll take it." And so Buzz Fulton sent me a contract, figured out the courses I teach, and they basically made an extra spot for me. I was the extra man for the next 2 years until one of the other teachers
So did that mean you were teaching everything, including the kitchen sink, during that year?
No, I started a machine shop program. They had some old machine shop equipment, and some of it wasn't used, some of it was in pieces. And so the ESD coordinator and I got together and and we were able to get used World War II surplus equipment for free. All we had to do was pay the shipping. And so we started a machine shop program, and I was able to teach drafting. There was another teacher that taught some drafting, and so we just kind of spread the load out and just offered more classes and more periods for kids to take classes.
Okay, so the master's program was 1 year in length?
Yes.
And you completed that. It sounds to me like the district basically created a job for you.
They did.
And then how long did you stay this time?
Well, I retired in 1998 with 32 years. I stayed an extra year working half-time because in 97, school year 97-98 would have been, they took my machine shop and they cut the program some years before that because of all this reduction in funding that was taking place. They felt they couldn't afford it. And it was hard to get kids to take that class because it was just, you know, a little more difficult than some of the other classes. And it was hard when to fill up, and they started on the numbers game about having 15 kids in a class or nothing. So anyway, it got cut, and I used it for crafts class for a while, but they came in and said, you know, we need more computer space. And I had started an AutoCAD program, and it was very successful. And so they converted my entire shop to a beautiful computer lab. And then they came in there, and they poured concrete on the floor to level it up, and carpeted it, and put beautiful drafting tables in there. So we had a computer on the corner and a spot for a drafting table. And I thought, you know, man, just to have the privilege of teaching in this lab. I've waited for this lab all my life. I stayed an extra year and taught two classes in drafting for the whole year. Just to have the privilege of working in that lab and watching kids, you know.
My understanding is there are many schools that, although the technology has really changed in drafting and they're using AutoCAD and that sort of thing, there's still, I hear, many schools that don't have even the basics.
That's right.
And so they're learning drafting the old way or the former way,
right,
which I don't think anybody uses in the real world anymore, do they?
Well, they do and they don't. The thing is, the basic skills are there to understand AutoCAD.
Yeah.
You know, the geometry that goes in. And you can ask anyone in the engineering field, when they hire someone that's never had drafting, manual drafting, they just had the computer, right away they can tell who they've hired. You can sure tell this person has never had board work, because they've never had the physical experience of seeing what should end up on a piece of paper of a certain size.
Mm-hmm.
It's all been based on that computer screen.
Yeah,
you know. But, you know, for several years we couldn't afford plotters. Well, now plotters have come down in price, and a lot of secondhand plotters are given to the school of the industry, so that's made a big difference. But still, the drafting, it crosses over, you know, like in the woodworking. A person needs to make a template of something. They can draw it out on some heavy paper and cut it out to make templates for metalworking and woodworking. So it isn't just like for learning how to design homes.
No, scene designers in theater work with AutoCAD a lot.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And they now have a scenic design instructor, professor there, who is familiar with that.
Ah.
So that may raise our design program up another,
mm-hmm,
another notch to have that capability.
Yeah.
Okay, so you came to LeGrand, you basically spent well over 30 years teaching for the LeGrand School District. Let's back up a step now. Now, when you first came to town, how did one become certified as a shop teacher?
Well, you have
or industrial arts.
Oh, well, you had to have an industrial arts degree. That was simple as that. The they never did, as far as I know, hire people off the street that had mechanical skills or industrial skills. They still wanted that degree.
And was it required, my understanding was it wasn't always required to be a bachelor's, it could be an associate's. Is that true?
No, you had to have a bachelor's.
Okay.
They had a few auto mechanics instructors come in, and who didn't have a degree, but they had to have it in their contract to finish up college work to get their degree eventually. Which is too bad.
Now,
there's so many skilled people out there that could really share their skills, but
I think they actually have ways of doing that now.
I was reading
on the TSPC website. So did you have to follow a specific, what did you take in education? Did you have to do student teaching?
Oh yeah.
Let's talk about that. How did a shop teacher become a shop teacher at all? Sort of, not in depth or detail, but how would you have done that in your day?
Well, most of the colleges, around the country were very well equipped with different shops, metalworking, woodworking, and the drafting, and printing, graphics, they had all these different fields. And you could kind of specialize. And I specialized in metalworking and the drafting end of it. And this buddy that hired out with me was specialized in the plastics industry and woodworking. That was his, cup of tea. And metalworking was always mine because I had a strong vocational program in high school. It was worth 540 hours towards an apprenticeship certificate that we got out of high school, which got me right into advanced rank in the Army, because they counted it. And they said, well, you know enough to where we don't even have to put you through our school. They just put you to work.
What kind of education coursework did you take? What was required for your field?
Well, we had to take all the required classes, educational psychology and methods of teaching, and we had to go through student teaching for a year. Well, we had a semester of student teaching. But, to even start in the Ed program then, we had to have a 10-day September experience. We could go into any school we wanted to. So I went back home. I went back to my machine shop teacher that taught me, and taught my dad and three brothers
in South Dakota.
So, we had to just participate in classes and do a little teaching here and there, and they would just turn us loose, whatever we felt comfortable with teaching at that time, and just take good notes it gave you a little check and balance as, do I really want to do this? And that was after the first, that was after the first 2 years of college, when we started to hone in on what we really wanted to do. So that was a good experience. After 10 days, you could say, I really do want to work with kids, or no, I think I would just go back to industry.
Now, when you first finished the program, your first job was in Oregon. So did you get Washington certification and transfer it?
Yes. So I had to go to Eastern and take a class in Oregon history. I had to pick up an educational psychology class that Oregon required that wasn't required in Washington.
Did they require this before you began in the classroom, or were you able to take this as you went?
I was able to hire out and do that the next summer.
So they didn't hold the job up for you on those two things?
No. Just from those two courses. I just had to agree to finish up that way.
Okay.
So it was like a temporary certificate the first year.
And then, what was your ultimate certificate? What did you hold when you retired?
It's just called a standard certificate.
Right. And it's good for?
Good for 5 years. At a time. And so when you renew it, you just have to have good reports, from your evaluations, and have 180 days of teaching minimum.
Will you be able to hold this certificate down the road?
I held it until this fall.
And then what?
And so now I couldn't, since the 5-year certificate ran out, I couldn't account for 180 days, sorry. You have to have 180 days to renew that certificate. So I was about 25 hours short from the substitute teacher. So anyway, they're pretty stringent on rules. So I just said, well, take that fee and apply it towards a substitute teaching certificate. So that's what I have now.
Okay. In the time that you were there in LeGrand at the high school, let's talk about what a typical day is like for an industrial arts teacher. It's going to be different from somebody who teaches lit or health, perhaps. What's the day in the life like for you then?
Well, you know, both my buddy and I felt that, you know, classroom instruction played a big part in a good industrial arts program. It wasn't just coming in and butchering on something. We felt like they needed to know something about the materials they're going to be working with, and safety is always a big issue, so we really hit them hard on safety and all the techniques of using the different power tools and manual tools before they even started to get really heavy and make a project, you know. So typical day was try to get there early enough to correct some papers from tests or worksheets that we had for them, and then we'd give demonstrations. Each day it was something planned for a certain machine or process. We'd give a good demonstration, and then we'd have work time, which they were always happy for. And then it was, you know, each period, you know, we had cleanup duties, and everybody had to clean up a certain area, which was always an important part of any good program, is to have good cleanup. So they would take that with them when they go to work someplace else. They just couldn't drop the tools and go home. They had to clean up their mess.
Right.
So anyway, it was, we did just as much paperwork, if not more, than a typical classroom teacher, because we had not only the paperwork, but we had machines to repair. You know, something's always breaking. And all the materials you have to order. It gets fairly complicated to get all these materials together and then figure out how much each person owes for what they're making. Especially if kids are making different things. If everyone is making the same project, it was pretty simple to have a bill of materials. But we required them to have a drawing of what they're going to make and a bill of materials, and they had to figure out the price. And so we worked all the math into there.
So they paid for their project according to the materials they used.
That's right.
What were some of the different courses that you taught?
Well, we just call it machine tool technology. And then I taught architecture drafting, and then mechanical drafting. And I taught crafts classes. After the machine shop was closed up, we still had the machines, so I just worked the crafts kids into it. And I had developed by that time a casting program for brass and aluminum castings. And we had wrought iron work going on, forging, wrought iron work, sheet metal work.
What applications would this type of background or training help your students do? How could they, I guess, realize the potential somewhere down the road? What?
Well, if someone wanted to just head for the trade, you know, they would really have a lot of advance knowledge before they even started a community college. I had almost every student that went on to any kind of a program connected with architecture, they'd always write back and ask them where they could get the textbook that we used. Because they're
in your class.
In our classes, because their textbooks weren't as thorough as the ones we had. They did not like the new books that they were getting involved with. So architecture students and drafting students, a lot of them would write back for the text that we were using.
So your classes did then, in fact, have real world potential and could advance your students who wanted to study those things when they went to college.
And we put a lot of kids to work right out of high school. You know, if they weren't ready for college or community college or trade school, a lot of them went to work in local industries. And then it was helpful to those that went into engineering too. Rod Sands, for example, in LeGrand, he works out of his home. He's an aeronautical engineer, does systems engineering. He worked for Boeing for 14 years. And I went to his high school class reunion. The first thing he said to me, "Oh man," he said, "if you only knew how valuable what you taught us was to us." He said, "It was the nuts and bolts that you taught us that really made a difference in my engineering." There's a kid by the name of Brian Houghton who is an engineer over there in Walla Walla at a food processing manufacturing, you know, all stainless steel. And he was saying, you wouldn't believe the kids that have graduated from college and they have no idea of machining and how to bend.
And it's December 17th, 2005. We're continuing the interview with Dave Mackey. And so we were talking about your students would say they'd be completing these projects.
Yeah, and what the value was of the coursework.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did that make you feel?
Pretty darn good. And even in math, I taught him in machine shop, I taught him industrial math. And in my mechanical drafting class, in architecture too, I tried to get some math in there that was trigonometry oriented. But it was the way industry does it, and it was the way I was taught by industry. I learned to do some of the math processes the way the industry people do it. And it's nothing like you for the most part, it's nothing like you do it from a math class.
So can you maybe give an analogy that would make that a little more clear to somebody? I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I know where that's going, but can you give an example of what?
Well, for example, like in machine shop, you have to figure taper per foot or taper per inch to cut a taper on a lathe. Think of a hammer handle with a taper on it or something.
Okay.
Or a cannon barrel with a
All
taper.
Right.
Well, there's a formula. And we used to hang these formulas on the wall. So if it comes to a problem like this, you know, here's your formula. Or you have a little notebook and copy that formula down. And then, so you plug these numbers in here and you solve the problem. And that's fine if that's all the free you want to take it. But I learned from a fellow that went as far as he could in instrumentation and electronics during my master's program. And he could see that a lot of kids were having struggle in math to solve problems. And so he started a class in industrial math. And he made the math department furious because the kids from the math department were going into the industrial arts department to take this class. And because of that, they were able to solve problems. And that department didn't like that. Now figure that one out.
Did that create any tension in the faculty room later?
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Between the math department and the industrial arts department. But it was like a summer class. It was one of the last classes I took in my master's program. The most valuable class I've taken in my life.
Huh.
I've always had a struggle with math, but it turned my life in math upside down. Now, I'm not a mathematician, but I can solve problems more than ever before from this method he taught, and it's just simple unit analysis. You'll see one chapter in a math book, you'll see one chapter in a chemistry book, and the chemistry book has it presented so confusing that only a math-minded person can understand it. But the way he taught it, he started off with something simple, like miles per gallon. You know, how do you figure fuel economy on a car? Do you divide the miles in the gallons or the gallons in the miles?
Right.
He said, don't even worry about what you divide. Ask yourself the question, what do I need to know? And put a PURR sign in. And it's, you can spell it P-U-R-R, but it's really spelled P-E-R.
Uh-huh. Right.
You know, so so what are you looking for? Create a formula. M-P-H. Put an English word with everything. Let English do your talking and walking to create a formula. So, miles per gallon, okay. Simple. You know, it gives you a start. It gives you a, it sets you up with a way to attack a problem. Okay, and I need miles. How many miles did I go? You know, how long did it take you? You write down units. You know, miles per trip. Okay, 250. Gallons per trip. You can write everything down in units also.
Right.
Then you just extract the units that you need to create your formula, and when it reads miles per gallon, quit and solve it.
You should have sent me some of my my fellow nursing students who were struggling so hard with pharmacology and all of that.
Well, I showed my wife, who's a nurse, you know, the same process, and she showed me her nursing book, and there they are.
Right.
If you're going to do this, you need to follow this formula.
And really, I think the formula we're talking about is known by a couple of names. Factor label, I think, is one. Some of the older, elder types, I've heard it called dimensional analysis, where you examine what you have versus what you need.
Mm-hmm.
And
see, and I still just, what are you going to teach us? I started getting some responses, you know, by writing on the board in English, you know, this word says to go hunting for this, because it's in English. So go, have you any information about this? Sure enough, you know, keep plugging in. And they sort of got it, and so we did another one, you know, and by then, Mr. Cal raised her hand. If I'd have known that yesterday, I could have passed this test. She got upset.
Hmm.
And the kid that fought me all that day came up at the end of that class. He was the last one out. I want you to know that was one of the best math lessons I've ever had. He shook my hand.
It was a light bulb on.
Oh, man. You know, and that's just the way I felt. It
right.
turned me on to not be so afraid of math. But I'm still afraid to take a college math because they're going to throw me into mystery. Kinds of things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I do know what you mean.
I don't care where the formula
came off on this math class right now.
And I don't care where the formula came from. Just show me how to get there. You know, either create my own formula or find the formula.
Right.
And when I was working in drafting, I worked my way through college in drafting. I worked for Bunker Hill Mine up in Kellogg, Idaho.
Uh-huh.
And the engineers were always throwing these figures out. You know, we'll take this times this and divide it by that, and you've got it. How did you do that? Well, they were doing analysis in their head, you know? And so, well, then I got thrown into trigonometry, which I didn't know anything about. And so, this one engineer, who happened to be a Finlander, he said, take this book home. It was a machinery's handbook. Big, thick book, about 3 inches thick. He said, I want you to study pages 274 through 276 tonight. And come in tomorrow and we'll start working on this project. And I had to build this tower with all these angles to be cut. And I had to have the dimensions figured out with trig so they'd be right. You know, you can draw something to scale, but a lot of times the dimensions aren't going to be as accurate.
Right.
So they have to be proven with the math. And so he started showing me how to work these formulas and applying the formulas, you know, to solve right triangle problems and unequal angle.
Was that a turning point for you to know that?
Oh, big turning point.
To know that information?
Or it just made life exciting because now I can do trig. No, I'm not a master in trig.
Right.
And you throw me into a college board exam about trig problems, that's nothing but X's and Y's, and they don't even want a real answer. They don't want a number with a decimal point behind it. No, I don't need that. I just need X minus Y,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
Okay, that's not for me. That doesn't solve problems in the real world.
True. Did you ever do any administrative work? Did you ever hold an administrative certificate or license?
No, and I never wanted to, because I enjoyed teaching industrial arts. I had some skills that I felt was worth sharing. If I had not, I don't know, I can't say that I mastered everything in my life, but since I felt I was pretty darn good at what I was doing, and I felt the need out there because, you know, other teachers didn't know what I knew. Most of them come from weaker programs or something.
Do you think that you may have been responsible for kids completing school who might otherwise have never done it?
I do. And they keep talking about, how can we improve education? What are we going to change? You know, please call such and such or write to .gov, you know, on the web,
uh-huh,
and give us your ideas. Well, all we see changes then is more math and science, more math and science. And we're ignoring the how to do. How do you make something that the whole world wants to buy? We're producing information, because we are now in the information age, right?
Right.
And the industrial age is over with, but it's really not. What about the people that repair and have to make parts? You know, look at Eagle Trucking Machine out here in the valley, how they've grown. I mean, here's a guy that was a self-taught machinist, and he'd become an engineer. Not by school, but by books. And everything that he designs, the engineer puts a stamp on. Because it's right. Because he's got the practical experience to go on the background with it, you know. Greg Bredo, he's a college man, I believe, he graduated from college. But look at Bredo Industries, out here at Hot Lake. He makes
right.
the world's best hydraulically driven rotor tiller. And trencher. He's a machinist by trade. His dad had a machine shop. And he fell in love with it.
Did you, now you've taught for all of this length of time, did you work at other jobs in the summers or other periods when you were off school?
My first summer I helped build a house in Richmond, Washington. Flew every day out of La Grande with a carpenter that owned the business and build a house, and then I worked for Anderson Interior Engineering. I was their first draft person, 1973.
Would you do this
summer.
In your off time?
Just in the summer.
In the summer.
Yeah. Yeah. I did. Working part time while teaching and coaching, I figured would never mix with industrial arts.
Thank you for saying that. I'm well aware that teachers have other responsibilities besides teaching. So what did you coach?
No, coaching was one of the things I didn't teach.
Oh.
Or didn't do.
Didn't do.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I figured that
okay.
would never mix with industrial arts teacher. When the kids are gone, you're repairing equipment.
Oh, I see.
You're fixing and repairing and you're always building and remodeling something to make it better for the kids and for yourself to make it enjoyable instead of having a dump to work in. You know, hanging tools in a proper place so the kids have a proper place to put it when they're done with them.
Okay.
And organizational things in your shop, it's just a never-ending battle. You look at good industries, boy, and they've got organization to no end. You look at industries that fail, and they just kind of have a big building and they slop around.
Now,
no organization.
Was that opposed by your administration when you first started? Did they want you to coach or do other things?
There was always pressure to be involved with the sports program somehow. One of the excuses was you'd probably be able to draw more kids into your classes if you coach. And I could see that, because a lot of teachers that just, you know, were book learning classes, they had the time. My gosh, they've got a teacher's manual and a set of worksheets, and all the tests are ready to go. All they got to do is say, do page so-and-so every other problem and correct the papers. That's it. What's there to do in your classroom? The janitors clean up after you. And there's no Nicholas thing. You know, you guys in industrial arts have it made. You can make anything you want. You've got these beautiful shops. And it's like, you know, I thought that was the way it was going to be too. Because a professor told me, he says, oh, you have a wonderful position to be in. You can create, design, and make things the rest of your life, you know. But then when the kids are there, there's no time for that. If you want to teach the kids something, if you want them to be skilled when you're done and really go on with it, there's no time to do much yourself.
So, because of what you said about spending all of your time maintaining equipment and repair and things like that, so are you saying that there was no budget or provision for this equipment to be repaired professionally?
That, well, it basically involves a philosophy of education that people aren't aware of. They think that, well, this is my opinion, but there's too many people out there that when you say vocational education, that's where the dummies go. And they've made it a dumping ground in too many places. And so I would get kids from my physics that were funking out. David, would you take this kid into your class? And I'd say, well, why don't you put him in chemistry first? There are other classes available besides me in woodworking, you know. We always were the first ones to get dumped on. And agriculture classes. They always kind of like hit the shops, you might say, first. So we just kind of got on the bandwagon. And every time they'd ask if we can take another body, which we were already full of, you know. And I'd take kids anyway. But they'd soon find out they had to be there to learn. And so it wasn't but a few days they would drop out. Because we'd get kids who just did not want to work. And they'd usually end up in art. Someplace where, you know, they could actually, you know, do something, but they didn't have to worry about tests and paperwork and, you know, they could produce something, and it could be a mediocre drawing or a painting, but, you know, they tried, and they were able to abide due time, you know. But we always felt like industrial arts, it was more than just coming in there to be a babysitter. Well, and it's a rip off to a kid who thinks that they're going to a dumping ground, you know.
Yeah.
And then also I told the counselors who come in. One counselor especially was just dumping on us all the time. I mean, here at that time when I taught, it was 18 maximum in a vocational class, where you had, you know, technical equipment going on. That was the safety line. Anything beyond that, your safety factor really can get rough for cutting off fingers or whatever. But now that's all ignored, you know. I mean, they've got classes with 30 kids in it now. They have a welding class in the Grand right now with over 30 kids in it.
To one instructor.
Yeah, and you know, maybe 18 or 20 welders.
Yeah.
And then what do the rest of the kids do? So we always said, you know, you guys expect us to lower our standards to accommodate these kids. Well, you know, physics teachers can lower their standards a little bit and still teach them some physics. Not make a college-bound kid out of this. Whatever body walks in the door, you know, like, oh, these are college-bound kids. Well, all of us need some physics, you know? All of us could use some chemistry. And so, you know, lower your standards a little bit and teach some of those kids and divide up your groups like we have to. We have to teach the kids who are going to college or to the trades.
Mm-hmm.
I had a kid write to me that went to West Point. And he wrote back after the first month and said, I just want you to know that all the hassles the kids gave you on trying to teach us some math, because it wasn't a math class, you know. They said they really hassled you on teaching them the math that we learned. He said, you call it unit analysis. It's called the systems approach here at West Point, for which I have found endless uses for. And I still have a copy of that letter in my file.
He was a student of yours.
He was a student of mine that went on into engineering after West Point. He became an engineer, you know. That was his goal to start with, to become an engineer. But he could see the value in machine shop and in drafting just as much as taking the math and the science. Because he got the real reasons why physics works, you know, the applications of physics and the applications of math. I mean, you know, you get kids in with trigonometry, a lot of math, and they can't solve an angle to set up a lathe to cut an angled surface on a lathe. And it was just a simple right triangle problem. But since it was on a lathe, and they could see a picture of the tailstock being offset to get that taper, they're just like, ooh, what do I do with this? But if you would have just said, you know, if you have a, you know, a triangle with X of something and a Y of something, what's the hypotenuse? Then that would be fine.
Although you might have lost me just on that last phrase, but I think I caught on.
But the answer would not have been like, you know, 4.78 inches. It would have been X plus 2.
Yeah. So now, when you finished your career teaching, and you say now you're substituting, how often do you do that?
The last couple of years, the last 2 years, haven't been very often. I've gotten to the point where if I have something to do, I'm busy when the phone rings. If I'm really tied up on it, well, you know, I'll get up and get ready on a project, like getting firewood in. And I'm heading out the door and you know, I have this goal in mind, but I don't have to say anything.
Right.
What I'm doing, I just say, I'm just swamped, I'm busy. I'm tied up today. They probably think I'm substitute teaching.
But they don't need to know.
Yeah.
So
anyway, I've skipped a lot of days for that. And then, like, at the beginning of the year, I've gone to some military reunions, you know, around Labor Day. And sometimes somebody will get sick right off the bat, you know, or go to conferences. Oh, can you come in? I'm about ready to leave for a military reunion. Oh, you lucky man.
Uh-huh.
That makes you feel so good.
Right, right. do you stick to industrial arts classes, or can you teach anything?
I can sub any level of high school or junior high school. I'm not qualified in all those areas, but, you know, the way things are set up, the way people can copy, make worksheets, and you're basically a glorified babysitter.
Well, you've even taught some grade school classes, haven't you?
I've done a few grade schools.
That's
on an emergency. Yeah, in fact, I did a little first grade class down here that really went well. And the teacher primed, you know. Now, we have a man coming in, and he used to teach this and this, and he lives in Cove. And when I walked in the door, all together, you know, hello, Mr. Mackey.
Uh-huh.
Oh, man, just a big greeting when I walked in the door, you know.
How was that particular day?
It was fun. You know, one by one, the kids would come up. Everybody wanted to make a connection. And so, Mr. Mackey, could you tighten my shoelace? You know, anything to get some help doing something.
Or attention.
You know, I can't sharpen my pencil without breaking it. Can you help me? Little things like that. Well, man, I found out, hey, I could handle some elementary school teaching.
Would you do more of that?
Oh, I probably could.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. In fact, you know, when I started out teaching, it was 7th and 8th and 9th all together. Well, those three grade levels, boy, that was a terrible mix. The 9th graders were way too much older than the 7th graders. And it just caused chaos all the time. Then they finally made a 4-year high school out of it and had the 7th and 8th grade. And I thought when I quit junior high school, I would never go back to that area. Well, there was about 4 years in a row in a row where I had to go back to the junior high and do half-time teaching with the other industrial arts teachers, team teach. But they gave me a drafting class for the seventh graders. And so I absolutely fell in love with those kids at seventh grade. Totally different. They were all eager beavers at seventh grade. Mm-hmm. What a difference. Mm. And I thought, you know, after those 4 years, I thought, if I could ever start over again now, I would want to teach seventh graders. And any eighth graders would be okay. So. Well, and see, seniors were my best students when I taught the first 15 years. And then it slid down to the juniors as being the best. Hmm. And now, by the time the kid is a junior, they really start dropping fast, and the seniors can be almost worthless.
Yeah, I think I agree there.
Our whole system has been, you know, tried to fix it, but they keep lowering standards and everything. And we'll look at your math classes. And instead of having more math that's better, they keep dumbing it down to make more lower levels, you know. Mm-hmm. And they got this spiral approach to teaching where you go around and around. You come back to the same thing. You never master anything on the way. And so the kids are constantly confused. The books don't even... I take old math books to school, so when there's a certain concept, I refer to my old math books. Or I'll point to it for the kid to read. Oh, now that's understandable. Well, that makes it easy.
Yeah.
Just a lot of new stuff out there that's sort of dumbing down America, I guess.
Let's talk about places you've lived in the county. You said you started out in this apartment building and you weren't married the first year. So when your wife and you got married, where did you first live?
I rented a small log cabin, which was just south of the experimental scientific lab up there on Declan. You know that, is it a Forest Service? I think it's Forest Service, and is it some fishing game stuff? No?
It is a federal building. I just toured it the other day, right at the
curve
there.
Well, you know where the office is for Dr. Pettit, the ophthalmologist, across the street?
Yeah.
Well, that right on that spot and back just a little bit, maybe up where the parking lot is, there was an old log cabin there. And my sister came out from South Dakota and went to college with me. Of course, you live with me, so she could have been Dan Eastern. And so she came out for that year. And so we moved from Shirley's apartment up to that log cabin. And then about the end of that year, the guy that owned it lived up behind. In fact, he was a college prof. Remember his name? Can't remember his name. But he came in, he said, "David," he said, "we've decided to sell." And he said, "Before you have to move, I will find you a place that is better than what you have right here." And he said, "Also, I will offer you to buy this place. You can buy this 1 acre of ground with a cabin on it for $5,000. And it was like, oh, how could I handle that? I was only getting paid $5,200 a year in that first year teaching.
Right.
I mean, $5,000, my word, that was like buying a $30,000 car now in today's world, you know. So anyway, that was just out of picture. I just, you know, I had no counseling as far as, you know, working money or buying things and how it could pay off in the future. You know, it'd be cheaper than paying rent. But he said, "I'm going to take you out of La Grande on the edge of town here, out by the county cemetery. There's a lady up there, Mrs. Eplin, Virginia. And they live out in the, right on the edge of town, up just west of the county cemetery. You might have been up there. And there's a little guest house in the back, which is made out of all pine, had a pine floor, and the living room was all knotted pine. The same material that was used in the living room of the main house. It was really cute. We rented that place for $35 a month. And that's where I learned to do plumbing, because the Epling place up there had about 35 outdoor faucets for gravity flow irrigation. And that's where I started to fix leaky faucets. And then a plastic pipe ran from the spring down to three rental homes that the gophers were all eating. And I learned how to dig ditches and fix a plastic pipe. You know, leaking pipes all the time. And just fixing things, maintaining the house. I got a lot of good maintenance skills. At 50 cents an hour, we basically had free rent for the first 5 years of our marriage.
When you moved into this guest house.
Yeah, we lived there for, the first 3 years, and then we went back to college. And the college prof rented the little guest house.
Oh.
His name was Lyle Nelson. And she said, now, if you come back, you'll have to move down the road into another rental. And there was a real shacky house down below. It's still there, this little white shacky home. So, were they living there to start with? I think they were living in this little shack, but they were able to move up into this really neat little guest house. And so when we came back, he said he'd want it for another, we wanted it back. So she raised the rent to, 65 bucks or something?
50 or 60.
It was still really reasonable, and the professor had to move back down to the shack. And he was a math teacher at the college. And he ended up pulling out and having his own business, but he was really good at computers. He taught some of the first computer classes, writing programs up there. He built a nice A-frame out here in the valley. So anyway, that was our second rental. And then Mrs. Eklund died. And her son came in and his ex-wife, and they started to kind of clear things out, and things were just not as like they were before. But we love this lady so much. She was just like a great-grandmother or something to us, And we just had fun taking care of her, And she needed help. So it was an enjoyable experience for us. But it looked like they were going to sell, so. We just told him, we started looking for a house. And it wasn't within a few days. And the ag teacher was getting ready to move to a different job. And we just basically walked into that home and didn't have to go through real estate or anything. So we bought our first home in 1973.
And this was a private arrangement?
Private contract with another teacher. And
well, we were able to take over his loan, his bank loan, which I guess you can never do anymore.
Yeah.
But they just
had
to
continue on with the
payments. You assumed the loan.
That's right.
And made a payment to him.
Yep.